Welcome to AI Snacks with Rami and Robbie. This AI literacy podcast aims at bringing knowledge and understanding of AI into families and companies. I am your host, Anastasia, CEO and founder of AI Edutainment and the creator of the Rami and Robbie book series. And for those watching on YouTube, I am having next to me the real Rami, who is my furry muse and the protagonist of the Rami and Robbie adventures. Today, I am recording the second episode with Victor Verdano. Victor wears a lot of hats. He's a comedian, filmmaker, cartoonist, creative technologist, and an entrepreneur. In the first podcast recording, we were discussing how he created Magic Bookify, a writing tool that includes a writing coach to help you with your first draft. Today, we continue exploring how AI tools can help neurodivergent people in writing and creative tasks. We will touch something which is very close to my heart, AI in schools and AI in education. And Victor will say something very simple, but crucial for all kinds of organizations to benefit from AI and adopt technologies smartly. You truly need someone in your school or in your business who truly understands AI. Easily said than done. There are tons of so-called AI influencers around who have never written a line of code and successfully implemented an AI project. So how to distinguish between those AI wannabes and the real folks? But now let me open the studio for Victor. Enjoy our fun exchange and tell me, what would you like to explore about AI in creative industries in 2026? This is the last podcast episode in 2025. We are now 6,000 people listening to this show. I'm tremendously grateful, and I wish you all the best in 2026. Okay, great. Victor, welcome back on my podcast. And let me just jump into the cold water asking you some questions about your path. So you wear tons of hats. So you're a comedian, you're a filmmaker, you're a cartoonist, creative technologist, and of course, you are an entrepreneur and a company founder. So if you need to introduce yourself when someone asks you, Victor, what do you do? What were the key turning points that took you from A to B to C? What would you answer?
I actually think that I'm just kind of an amalgam of all the things I was when I was a child. When I was a child, before I was a comedian, before I was a cartoonist, I would walk from my house to the mall to use the computers at Radio Shack so that I could learn basic programming. So that's who I was before I did any of this other stuff. And so, yes, I've been in movies, and yes, I do stand-up comedy, but I'm still that kid who loves technology.
So that's interesting. So you were describing yourself on a couple of occasions as feeling a bit like a robot trying to understand humans. And could you please elaborate on what does it mean?
I think that, okay, I'm about to tell everybody how crazy I am. Here we go.
Fantastic.
I think that life, the more that I learn about life and the more that I live, I think that life is pretty simple. There are very, very simple answers. And I think that if you can't understand those simple answers, then I don't understand you. And so the simple answers that I have are based on logic, I think. And so that is probably why, you know, my whole company is called Supreme Robot. It's just like, I look at things and I think if A and B, then C must be true. And that's all I do. And I have so many formulas for everything in the world. And I look at people and I will explain things to them very simply. And then they will take in that information. And then they will go the opposite direction. I can give you an example.
Yeah, please.
I have a friend who just, they ended their marriage. This is not me. This is my friend. I know that we were talking earlier, but I'm just letting you know. I have a friend who just ended their marriage, and then they're not happy with their other person and their ex. And then also their ex is not communicating with them. And then they're very upset every day. Every phone call I have with them, they're very upset. So I broke it down into, I said, let me ask you two questions. The second question is two part. And the first question is a yes or no question. Here's the yes or no question. One, can you be happy? Yes or no? Like no caveats. Is it is it possible? Yes or no? And then she was like, yes. And I was like, okay. Question number two is not what would it take you to be happy, but does it take something for you to be happy? And that was the second question. And then she was like, clarity. I want to know. And I was like, okay, here's the second part to the second question. Assuming that never comes, are you never going to be happy? And the answer was no. And I was like, well, might as well get started now.
So actually, it's genius. But you kindly condensed the whole history of the world literature and ours into a very simple algorithm.
That's so, exactly what I do. I make algorithms for myself.
But you know what is kind of interesting? So there was an experiment. So don't try to ChatGPT, let's say, what is going on in The Lord of the Rings. And God bless you if you try to do this with Anna Karenina. Mm-hmm. So because actually the short summary of Anna Karenina is the novel itself. So this is the saying Tolstoy did his short summary of World and Peace in writing World and Peace. So the beauty and the thing, which is all outside of your algorithm, and of course, A, B led to C, maybe again to B and again to A. This is like a vicious circle, right? Or somehow a Bermuda Triangle. But everything in between, this is what makes us humans, us yes. muggles. And let's say on the edges, there are tons of professions, including therapists and pharmaceutical companies making money on everything in between. So once again, if you try to describe what you do, and I mean, you work across tons of artistic disciplines, would you then respond, I just try to squeeze whatever it is into an algorithm, or what would be your answer?
I like to make things that I enjoy. Everything that I make, I absolutely enjoy. I think it's the coolest thing. I make an app that I use and enjoy. I make media that tickles me and makes me laugh. I make jokes that make me laugh. Like, I just make things that I enjoy, very simply. And I try to, if I'm making something that I enjoy, I try to also make something that might be helpful to other people, if it can be. Sometimes things I enjoy are not helpful to other people at all. But I have one friend who likes to send pictures of poop that we see on the street to each other. I have one friend that I enjoy that, and she enjoys it. And so we could send pictures of poop to each other that we see on the street. But, you know, that doesn't help everybody.
You wouldn't have a lot of luck in Switzerland, you know? They collect poop from the street. So this is interesting. So it's kind of, so once the Maslowian pyramid of need is completely, let's say, intact, right? So there's mm-hmm. food, there's shelter, there's Wi-Fi, some addition to the modern kind of Maslowian pyramid. So then we
dwell into... Wait, what did you call the pyramid? I'm learning from you now. What?
No, I mean, this is this pyramid of the basic needs. And obviously, it looks like a triangle. And, you know, first you need to have some food, and you need to have a roof, you know, so shelter, protection, and then da-da-da-da-da up to the top.
What is it called again, the pyramid, so I can look it up?
Maslowian, so Maslow, a psychologist who is attributed to have developed it. There are discussions whether he truly has.
That has great interest for me because I've always thought of the idea that, like, you know, if you're at ease, you're living at ease, like probably this pyramid that you're describing, then you're living the same life as the richest person in the world, the poorest person in the world who's also at ease. It's just all the same.
That's very, very, very true. This is very, very true because there are tons of studies starting with what income, there is more or less no difference in, let's say, living... They're not calling this living at ease, but living happily. Mm-hmm. And actually, this is not quite a huge amount. So it was something around $100,000. Mm-hmm. So maybe now if we measure so the inflation and everything, what is going on, it might be more. But to really kind of, you know, keep certain things intact, that person doesn't need to suffer. Mm-hmm. And then it's up to the person to evolve, to do stuff, to, you know, to create. This is not a huge amount. We are not talking about millions of US dollars. And then, of course, in the modern age, because of the hyperconnectivity, we require Wi-Fi, though some people might claim we need to get it out of our system and digitally detox, which might be difficult. Yeah.
I think that I think that I've been obsessed with living at ease, and then I've been obsessed with building the perfect system to do it and to make that system the least amount of work that I have to do. And I think I found it. And so I'm actually trying to do it right now. I'm building a system where I'll get paid. I'll get like $100,000 a month as a budget for myself. And then there'll be nothing else really much to do or build, and it's self-sustaining.
Well, congratulations.
Well, so if it works, is quite we'll see.
But why shouldn't it? Why it shouldn't?
And actually, I agree. Why shouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And so then, if this system is to work, obviously, there's a type of ecosystem subscription play, I guess.
It's not. I'll tell you everything.
Now I'm very curious. Then tell me.
let me tell you the system. Okay, because yes. there's multiple layers of the system that keeps making more. But here's the first part. The core part of the system is a newsletter. Okay,
yes.
So there's new technology for newsletters. I don't know how familiar you are with newsletters, but basically they'll give you an ad. Like you don't have to look for an advertiser anymore. Okay, so the more people you have on a newsletter, the more money you can make. So the secret is to make a newsletter that will build up really fast and that people want to stay on. So I attach my newsletter to a video game arcade that I made online.
Yes, you told me. Yeah.
That meaning people stay on the newsletter because they want to know when the next contest is. They do. And so I'm doing a push this week to try and get 100,000 people on the newsletter. If I get 100,000 people on the newsletter this week, that brings up my recurring revenue to about $50,000 a month. And then by February, I want it to be 200,000.
Yeah.
And then that's it. It's really simple. So all I have to do is continue to make video games and send out a newsletter that people want to get. And that's it. It's really simple.
So you are, but you need really to attract those video gamers, and you're kind of, I'm not saying alienating, but you're saying, okay, so the audience who might be willing to enjoy your content but is not into video games, I really admit I'm not.
Oh, I understand that's also why I hired video game influencers to spread the word about. Yeah, so I'm not just hoping that people show up.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. But well, congratulations. And could you please tell me, so when you decide on the experience and UI, so it should be really, it should have a certain feel and certain simplicity to it. So how do you make those decisions?
I think part of, because of my neurodivergence, and I know this because my brother has the same thing, is we hate obstacles. Obstacles are like, If I want to sit down and do something, I don't want to have to do a lot of prep work before I do something. In fact, I split things up into I'll do the prep work and then I'll leave and I'll come back later and then do the work. So we hate obstacles. So whenever I'm building something, if there's an obstacle, I try to eliminate it. So I try to make my things very simple to understand, to implement, to enjoy.
Very much Steve Jobs of you. Only one button to push and this is it. So, to really get to it, it's kind of difficult. And Leonardo da Vinci said that the most sophisticated kind of, thing about art is simplicity, and about science, it's simplicity. So this is the most sophisticated thing in the world.
You're making me upset. I'll tell you why. Is because I have avoided going and studying everybody. And now it's like, I should go.
You might not need to, but it's actually, so everyone is different. I'll tell you, so what happened to me in February last year. So I was, struggling with a couple of things, and I was kind of, okay, so what should I do for myself, which will be really me time. So no, not for the family, so not for the daughter, so just me, not really a job thing. And I will really greatly benefit from it. And then I just recalled, so I was an obsessive reader as a child and as a student. I love books. So I'm surprised. I have Kindle and stuff, but I still have like 2,000 books at home. And I decided in the month of March, I will read one book a day. So I was up before 5 a.m. and this is what I was doing. So I was reading novels. I was reading biographies, art books, sometimes astronomy, mathematics, all what was out there. And it was very interesting because it filled my system with so much information and kind of noise. But at the end of the month, I was so clear on what the second Romy and Robbie book will be about, how we'll go after structuring this book and producing this in 2026, what I want to achieve with my podcast. I even did not take any note of anything professional during this reading month. But it just occurred after I consumed all this information, which was not related to AI and to anything I'm doing professionally. It was kind of interesting. So everyone is very different how one comes to certain outcomes, I guess.
I love that. And you're quite an astute thinker. Where can I find more people like you?
So you visit me in Switzerland. I will introduce
it's
you
not,
to tons of
not
people.
It's not Switzerland.
No,
wish
I mean,
it was, I wish you could go
folks,
to a certain geographic location and
no,
everybody
no, no,
was
no,
a great thinker.
My folks are all over the place. So I mean, I have a very kind of, you know, heterogeneous circle of friends, and they all get to my place once a year for kind of, you know, get together thing. And there's always a house concert because I'm very much into classical music and, you know, people read from their books and there are tons of discussions. And of course, I know tons of a technologist because, you know, I started in AI in 1989. It's kind
Amazing.
Of difficult not to be immersed in technology. But let me come back to what you are describing. So this neurodivergent thing. So you told me during the last recording that your Magic Bookifier is fantastically suited for neurodivergent people because it helps them in their focusing and then they get really certain things done. Could you talk a little bit more about the design of your tool and how those people respond? And I know that you are doing something in education, working with a foundation, which is working with schools. So could you please talk a little bit about this project?
Absolutely. So the particular feature inside the Bookifier that we're talking about is called the Writing Coach.
Yeah.
And the way the Writing Coach works is it's really like an interview. It is like replacing the work that a ghostwriter would do for you if they were going to help you write the book. And so as for me, one of the hardest things for me is like looking at a blank page and where to start. It's easy for me to say, I want to write a book about my trip to France, but it's hard for me to know where to start. But what I did was I made an app that you can start with that little bit of information, and then it'll ask you questions to draw it out of you until you have your whole story done, which is so useful to me as a person who has a problem starting. Is just if I had the attention of an expert who would just sit and ask me questions about what I'm trying to write, I could definitely get the work done much faster. And so I built a machine that does that.
And how do you explain the difference between cognitive offload and cognitive discourse in your tools? And why is this distinction important at all, if it is important for neurodivergent writers and students?
Well, cognitive offload and cognitive discourse, I explain the difference in a metaphor about Einstein.
Okay.
So cognitive discourse is when you have access to Einstein and you say to Einstein, hey, I'm working on this problem. And then you talk about it back and forth. And then you learn through that conversation through cognitive discourse. Cognitive offload is when you have Einstein and you're like, hey, Einstein, here's my homework. Do it. And you just shove Einstein with your pile of papers and you turn your back. And that's cognitive offload, which most people do with AI.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is how they don't learn.
Yeah, you don't learn that way. Not at all.
Absolutely. By the way, there's quite a nice German joke about Einstein. I mean, I don't know whether it was true, but he did not start talking until he was, let's say, 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
And his family was very upset. They were quite worried. And so the saying is that one evening, so they were having dinner and out of sudden he said, so this soup is really cold. And the parents were overjoyed and they applauded and they said, oh my gosh, you can talk. This is wonderful. And why did you not communicate earlier? And he said, yeah, well, but earlier everything was in order.
That's a good joke.
So along the same lines. So if you think about adapting your writing coach software for schools, so could you talk about how your engagement with schools started?
Yeah, there actually has been a lot of forward motion since the last time we talked. So my engagement for with school started with me reaching out to Rising Tide Educators, to Dr. Julie Lopacher, who is the one who runs that, and that they specialize. She's also a professor at USC. They specialize in helping neurodivergent students reach higher learning. And so she reviewed the project. So I wrote it up like as a project. I called it Bright Write. And I wrote up as a project, like a proposal. And then I gave her the proposal, and then she reviewed the actual software, and she agreed. And then she agreed to partner with me. And then at this point right now, I also have a grant writing company that I'm working with that is helping me finish the grant for the National Science Foundation for Bright Write. And I have also spoken at a couple of schools, one in Minnesota recently, where I spoke in front of a board of teachers, and we're talking to them about like implementing AI in schools and what that might mean. And so it's moving along little by little. There's actually, I owe people a couple of emails before the holidays, so I need to get on that today, come to think of it.
So whenever I talk to schools, so I visit a lot of schools because I do schools readings, so of my first AI literacy book, so the first Romy and Robbie. And whenever I communicate with teachers, they are either completely horrified about AI, or they are like in ecstasy and excitement, but there is nothing normal or nothing in between. So I guess this is due to lack of information and a lack of AI literacy among teachers, but there might be other reasons. So how do you perceive what is going on with teachers?
I think that the solution right now is for organizations. I actually said this at the meeting that I had with the people in Minnesota, Minneapolis. I think that organizations need someone trustworthy and extremely knowledgeable with AI inside their organization, because they're going to be preyed upon by people who have enough knowledge in AI to swindle you.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that everybody's trying to swindle them. Some of them, they just don't know what they're doing. They think they know, and they just don't know. And that's, and it is abundant out there. And then nobody knows how to evaluate the work that they're getting. I think that should be the first step with every organization to, like, if there were a company right now that all they did was like vet great people with AI and then help place those people at companies, I think that that would be a really good thing. I don't think that companies are ready right now to hear that, but I think that it's something that should happen, because I think that would solve like a bunch of problems, because they like, If they can't make a decision about what to do with AI if they don't completely understand it, and they won't understand it until they get somebody in their organization who is on their side and understands it.
So this is another, business model to have organization of chief AI officers or chief education officers with knowledge about AI to get leased to whoever, to schools, to universities, to companies. And actually, Victor, you nailed it. So this is the reason why so many AI-related pilots and projects fail. So, you know, people don't know how to evaluate the vendor, and they believe all kinds of fairy tales. And then they don't know how to prepare their environment, how to prepare the data, what to focus on. And then they expect some fairy tale-like outcomes. And then the reality kicks in. And actually, that might be an interesting company to create, let's say, union of those leaders with great AI understanding who would just go, to companies and give them the knowledge and help them to start. And by the way, this organization would be McKinsey or BCG, because frankly, I observed them on a number of occasions, and they don't know what they're talking about when it comes to AI. But, you know, I wonder, they are technical skills, and they are certain skills which we must hone as human beings. So I think a lot about this. In my eyes, there are two subjects which should be taught throughout the schools and university programs, independently whether you study art or biology. And those two subjects, for my taste, are writing, creative writing, and applied math. So not theoretical math, but let's say, what is useful really to understand the world, for example, like statistics. And we need to educate teachers to teach those subjects, because those two are foundational subjects for every single thing what we have. And even if you are a mathematician, but you know how to write, then you will communicate your expertise in a much more eloquent way At the same time, if you are in humanities, understanding how clinical study is structured, why, let's say, economy is doing this way or that way, this is not, a knowledge which will hurt you. So how do you think about what humans must know? And then obviously technologies will help.
I think that I think the same thing you think, but I say it in a much simpler way. People need to learn how to reason. People need to learn how to communicate. Reasoning helps you. Whatever information that you get, you can reason through it. That's great. And then whatever you want or you need or you need to convince somebody or convey, you can communicate. You need to learn how to reason. You need to learn how to communicate because you're going to have a lot of information thrown at you. And you can either take that information and make your life better, or you can not understand how to reason through that information. And that might be a problem.
Brilliantly stated. So let us move to another area of your creativity toolbox. You are a cartoonist at The New Yorker, an iconic magazine. And could you please tell the story of your very first cartoon for The New Yorker? And what that moment meant for you as a creator? When was it?
I absolutely can tell the story. The first time I went into The New Yorker, I have a friend who is a New Yorker cartoonist. Her name is Karen. And she kept urging me. She's like, you're funny. You should try to be in The New Yorker. And so then I finally, at one point, I was like, I keep saying that I could be in The New Yorker. And so let me try. And then so I made 10 cartoons and I went into The New Yorker. And then I sat down with the cartoonist editor and I showed her my cartoons. And then she was like, oh, this one's funny, this one's funny, and this one's funny. She picked 3 of the 10 that I had. And I was like, awesome. And then I left and I was like, I think I just sold 3 cartoons. And then Karen goes, that's awesome, Victor. And then I told my mom and I was like, I sold 3 cartoons. And then at the end of the week, nothing happened. And I was like, Karen, what happened? How come my cartoon didn't get published? She was like, oh, well, she takes 3 cartoons and then she takes them to the head editor. And then they make a decision after that. And I was like, Karen, why didn't you tell me? And she was like, you were so happy. And I was like, Karen, and I forgave her immediately. Just so everybody knows, all New Yorker cartoonists are completely insane. She just let me tell my mom. Anyway, so after a year of submitting after that, I actually got one in.
So this is really insane. So this is really insane. If you need to kind of, teach yourself to be patient, this is, you don't need to go to the monastery. You just need to start working for The New Yorker.
So it was a year of submitting after that. And then I finally got in with a cartoon that was me complaining about something that happened to me at a bar. I was at a bar and it was my local bar and I was talking to some guy there. And then he said something racist. And then I was like, I'm black, by the way, just so you know. And then he goes, you know what I think about black. And so the cartoon that is in The New Yorker is a black person sitting talking to a white person at a bar. And then underneath it says, I hope you're ready for some unsolicited advice.
It's absolutely brilliant. But I mean, if you remember so this experience, what was actually your favorite cartoon from this 1 year period? Was it the one which was then released as your first cartoon?
No, my favorite cartoon, they rejected it. And I still think it's my favorite cartoon. It is a death cartoon. There's a little kid and he's opening the door and then death is at the door. And the kid is looking over his shoulder yelling, Grandpa, it's for you.
So the New Yorker wanted to avoid some lawsuits or whatever, some sensitivities. Or maybe it was post 21st century, because I guess this cartoon would be absolutely admitted, 100 years ago, probably. I guess a lot of people are using AI tools today. And obviously, I need to ask about this because we are on AI Snacks, which is an AI literacy podcast. So they use the AI tools for research, for trying things out, for maybe combining certain elements which are difficult to combine if it wasn't for this AI software. But do you think AI entered the ecosystem of New Yorker, like really properly, that editors are consulting it? How do you think about it? Do you know?
I don't know. Here's what I do know. I know that a lot of the New Yorker cartoonists absolutely hate AI in all of its forms, including my friend Karen. And I keep trying to ease her into the world of AI, but she's pretty stubborn right now. And then I know that the New Yorker as an institution looks down on AI. I think everyone is using it privately. 100% believe that. 100% believe it.
Did someone publish a collection of cartoons about AI?
I don't know, maybe. I mean, I'm sure someone has at this point, but I don't know of it.
Because there should be tons of jokes about AI. But, you know, from someone who really is an actor and, you know, a tool maker and a cartoonist. So where did you see AI having the most impact? And people are quite silent about this side of AI from your vantage point.
Where do I see it having the most impact?
Yes.
All right. So I think I know where it could have the most impact, but I don't know where it will have the most impact. I think it could have the most impact with every person getting a second opinion on what they're working on if they were taught how to use it correctly. Like everything that you're doing could be improved. That's always been the case. You've never had access to a tool that can help you improve everything you do. So it could have amazing positive impact all across the world. I don't know if that's going to happen, but it could.
Maybe, but it requires quite a level, probably, of self-awareness as well to admit you require the second opinion, and probably a lot of people wouldn't allow for this to happen. Victor, I would love to ask you quite a big question. So if you are to design an AI literacy course for creative folks, writers, musicians, architects, movie makers, what would you include in such a course?
I feel like it would have to be like a working studio sort of class, because the way I get the most learning done as an artist is by doing. And I think it should be a class where it's like, let's just do projects. Let's just keep doing projects over and over again. And by doing projects, you can't work with AI and do a project without getting an idea for another project. I think all it would take was just like one awesome project with someone who is confident using AI and knows like the variety of things that you can do.
Would you maybe one day create such a lab for people to try?
No.
And which could be a franchise? You wouldn't?
No, sort of. Okay, so I have a thing where I hate teaching people, because the only class I've ever taught where I was like, this is a great, actually two classes I've taught that are great subjects to teach. One is video games. Teaching kids how to make video games, every kid is leaning forward and wants to learn, and it's the best. I've also taught screenplay writing in college. Awful. The kids, half of them don't want to be there. Some of them just can't even, like, shouldn't even be trying. It's the worst way to teach. And so I don't like to teach anybody who doesn't want to learn. And that includes artists with AI. I don't want to force it down their throats. And so I'm not going to make a course and be like, please come take this course. No, I'm not even interested in that. By the way, the other thing that you can teach that everybody wants to learn is improv, not theater, improv specifically. Everybody in an improv class wants to because they want to be lazy and they think that they're funny. So they all want to learn. And when they start, a lot of people are gifted, but, you know, people take it initially and are interested because they think that could just easily be hilarious.
Well, I mean, here's the biggest danger probably of AI. People believe it will help cutting corners and increase in whatever proficiency, but instead it's kind of, you know, prey on the mediocrity. And to my saying, to my knowledge, really, AI helps those who are already great. And then
it does.
They can become even better.
I want to hunt down. There was like some study where they found that like a lot of people were like increasing the time it takes them to do tasks by using AI.
Yeah.
I don't remember where the study, I remember seeing that and thinking, oh, I want to read more about that. But, you know, it wasn't, I guess, a top concern for me, but that was really interesting.
So, Victor, my last question. So if you had like a magic wand to wave, and you could fix one thing about how society currently approaches AI, what would this something be?
I think the something would be, sorry, my first thought was totally evil. Okay, here's my second thought. My first
now
thought
I'm curious,
was,
what was the first?
No, my first thought was, you know how like the pandemic happened and then everybody started using Zoom and now everybody's used to it. Like something should happen that forces people to use it. But I was like, I don't want people to suffer. I don't want that to happen. But if there was something that got people to use AI en masse, that would be the something. But I don't want it to be something that makes anybody suffer. So I don't know what it is, but that is what I would do with the magic wand. I would create that something that makes no one suffer, but kind of like gets people to hunker down and use it.
So this is really interesting and it's really wise because what I observe in the enterprise area, in the production, in companies producing machines operating all around the world, there's a huge exodus of the employees due to the demographical trends. They aren't any young apprentices entering the food chain, and all the people retire, which brings us to the necessity to automate and to use AI, because otherwise we will simply lack adults. Not only that, we are lacking children, we are lacking people really to do the work and to keep the knowledge intact within the company. So you must automate, you must use AI, and then the question is how and what the transition will look like. But maybe this COVID type of a moment, more extended, is already happening, and companies which will wake up to this earlier will win, and others probably will go down. As simple as that. It's like economical Darwinism.
And that's interesting to think about. Although unlike COVID, it's not like a hard stop, because COVID was like a hard, like suddenly people had to use Zoom. Grandma had to figure it out. You know, like
absolutely.
It was immediate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Victor, it was such a huge pleasure talking to you. I would absolutely love bringing you back in a year to discuss what happened with schools, with what happened with your video games and with your newsletter. I wish you all success imaginable. And thank you really to make me laugh and to give us such a great content. And I'm subscribing to your magic bookifier because I love testing new tools. I love trying them out. I'll let you know how I like it. I'm quite convinced that I will love this writing coach.
Please do, because I'm about to rebuild the whole thing. So like, let me know, because once it's rebuilt, you know, I'll definitely take into advisement everything that people have told me.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And enjoy your Christmas season and a very, very happy 2026 for you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. And this concluded the last episode of the year 2025. Thank you for your feedback. Thank you for providing me with ideas for guests and for content. This very podcast, my books, the Romy and Robbie series, and my bi-weekly blog on aiedutainment.ai aim at demystifying data technologies and giving you tools that you can use every single day. This podcast is supported by listeners like you. Please go on my book website, romyandrobbie.ai, or on amazon.com and order a copy of Romy, Robbie, and the Secrets of Sleep. And there's a big news I would like to announce. On the 2nd of January 2026, I'm having the very first meeting of the editorial board for the second Romy and Robbie. And this time, my protagonists will translate the language of marine animals with the help of AI. I will let you know about the progress of this book in course of the next year. Thank you so much. Good luck, best success, and a very happy 2026.